Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, 4th chapter, text 68. Sadavo Ridayam Mayam. Sadavo Ridayam Mayam. Sadunam Ridayam Tuaham. Sadunam Ridayam Tuaham. Maranyate na jananti. Maranyate na jananti. Naham tebyo managapi. Naham tebyo managapi. Sadavo ridayam mayam. Sadunam ridayam tuham. Maranyate na janati. Naham tebyo managapi. Others. Vaishnavis. Sadava, the pure devotees, Ridayam, in the core of the heart, Mayam, of me, Sadunam, of the pure devotees also, Ridayam, in the core of the heart, to, indeed, Aham, I am, Mat Anyat, anything else but me. Te, they. Na, not. Janati, no. Na, not. Aham, I. Tebya, then them. Manak api, even by a little fraction. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The pure devotee is always within the core of my heart, and I am always in the heart of the pure devotee. My devotees do not know anything else but me, and I do not know anyone else but them. So we could say that one together. The pure devotee is always within the core of my heart. And I am always in the heart of the pure devotee. My devotees do not know anything else but me, and I do not know anyone else but them. Purport. Since Durvasa Muni wanted to chastise Maharaj Ambarish, it is to be understood that he wanted to give pain to the heart of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For the Lord says, Sadavo Hridayam Mayam. The pure devotee is always within the core of my heart. The Lord's feelings are like those of a father who feels pain when his child is in pain. Therefore, offenses at the lotus feet of a devotee are serious. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has strongly recommended that one not commit any offense at the lotus feet of a devotee. Such offenses are compared to a mad elephant, because when a mad elephant enters a garden, it causes devastation. Therefore, one should be extremely careful not to commit offenses at the lotus feet of a devotee. Actually, Maharaj Ambarish was not at all at fault. Durvasa Muni unnecessarily wanted to chastise him on flimsy grounds. Maharaj Ambarish wanted to complete the Ekadasi Parana as part of devotional service to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore he drank a little water. But although Durvasa Muni was a great mystic brahmana, he did not know what is what. That is the difference between a pure devotee and a so-called learned scholar of Vedic knowledge. The devotees, being always situated in the core of the Lord's heart, surely get all instructions directly from the Lord, as confirmed by the Lord himself in the Bhagavad Gita 10:11. Tesham eva anukampartam aham agyan ajam tamaha nasyami atmabhavishto gyana dipena bhashvataha. Out of compassion for them, I dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. The devotee does not do anything not sanctioned by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As it is said, Vaishnavera kriya mudra vigneha na bujaya. Even the most learned or experienced person cannot understand the movements of a Vaishnava, a pure devotee. No one, therefore, should criticize a pure devotee, a pure Vaishnava. A Vaishnava knows his own business. Whatever he does is precisely right because he is always guided by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Aginatam Anandasha Jananjana Shulakaya Chakshurna Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam. Jai. So before I start talking about today's verse and translation and purport, I'd like to just say a little bit, something more about Brahmananda Prabhu, who we, as we know, passed away yesterday. And, you know, fortunately, we got to see yesterday at breakfast time, those who were there saw him speaking about his memories of Prabhupada. That was really nice. And you know, and I've been told that there's going to be a program, a memorial program, in his honor. And I don't know when that is or who's in charge of it. Whoever is organizing that, if they'd like, I've got a copy of this book, Swamiji, that was written by Satyaraj, and it's sort of like, you know, a biography of Brahmananda and his association with Prabhupada. So if that, whoever's in charge of organizing that program would like to borrow this, if they don't already have a copy, they're welcome. And just what I wanted to say about Brahmananda is he was one of Prabhupada's confidential associates. You know, just like in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you read Lord Chaitanya, he performed his pastimes with different devotees, and you know, they had confidential associates. So in the same way, Prabhupada had certain devotees that he, you know, had a very special relationship with them, and Brahmananda was one of them. You know, he had a lot of, he was very close to Prabhupada, and he was a very special devotee. He was actually, I think I mentioned this yesterday, when he was the first temple president within ISKCON, and the way that happened was this. Prabhupada, this is back on 22nd Avenue, Prabhupada was wanting to have some officers, you know, for that first temple there. So he asked Brahmananda, he said, so, you know, I think we should have some officers, you know, who do you think they should be? I think we should have a secretary, a treasurer, and a president. So Brahmananda said, well, I think that Satsrup Maharaj would make an excellent secretary, and I think Gargamuni, his brother, would make a good treasurer, and I think Rai Ram would be an excellent temple president. And then Prabhupada looked at him and said, no, I want you to be temple president. So he appointed him. You know, he was appointed temple president by Srila Prabhupada. I mean, you know, that says something. It gives you some idea of what Prabhupada's estimation of him was. So, and then, of course, it was mentioned also that he was instrumental in getting the Bhagavad Gita published, printed. That was another, you know, big feather in his cap. And then at a later date, Prabhupada actually sent him to Pakistan. You know, just to give you an idea of what a fully surrendered soul he was, Prabhupada sent him to Pakistan, and this was during the time when there was a lot of tension. You know, this was like, I think it was just before some, like, Paco, I don't know how they refer to Paco-Indo War or something like that. And there was a lot of tension there. There was a lot of hatred between Hindus and Muslims, and Prabhupada sent him and his brother to Pakistan to preach in East and West Pakistan. And there's a little story behind that. Prabhupada was preaching in Mumbai at some Pandal program, 30,000 people there. And somebody challenged at the end of the question and answer period, at the end, somebody challenged. Yeah, you know, here you're preaching here in India, you know, we all know about this. We're all Hindus already. We all know about this. If you really, you know, if your preaching is so wonderful and everything, why don't you do something in Pakistan? Like that, the man challenged. And Papa said, yes, yeah, we will. We will send some of our sannyasis there. So in responding to that challenge, Prabhupada wrote a letter to either Gargamuni or Brahmananda saying, you know, this man said this at the end. I think we should have something there. I'd like you to go to East Pakistan and your brother go to West, or vice versa. I can't remember. But that's how it happened. So Prabhupada sent that letter, and off they went. You know, that at that point, Gargamuni was starting up, preaching in Gainesville, and Brahmananda was in Tallahassee. They were both, you know, doing well, preaching nicely. But they got that letter from Prabhupada, and that, you know, they were fully surrendered. They didn't think, well, wait a second, we're doing something really good here, and but it's really dangerous over there. Order to the spiritual master came, and, you know, okay, let's do it. And then they went. And it was really dangerous there. When they got there, Brahmananda describes how, you know, he wasn't welcome. I mean, people were kind of like harassing him as he was walking through the street. And, you know, when he'd sit down to chant or something like that, people came up and rubbed the tilak off his forehead. People would spit in his face. He was put in jail at one point. I mean, it was dangerous. I mean, actually, according to what, you know, the descriptions from both him and his brother, they came this close to, you know, getting killed on many occasions, you know, when they were in there. And ironically, later on, it was found out that Prabhupada sent another letter. 1 week after he sent that initial letter, Prabhupada sent another letter saying, actually, don't go. I've changed my mind. Don't go. It seems it's too dangerous there now. The political tension is building up too much, and I don't think it's a good idea. They never got that letter. They were already gone. They'd already left. You know, so they weren't procrastinating. They got the order of the spiritual master, and boom, off they went. So anyway, finally, how it all ended was there was some article came out in the in a Pakistani newspaper that four missionaries, Hindu missionaries, had been killed in Pakistan. And the local paper picked it up. A local Indian paper picked it up. And it was brought to Prabhupada's attention. And Prabhupada was in total anxiety, thinking that, you know, Brahmananda had been killed. And he had a devotee with him, Jananivas. And anyway, finally, Brahmananda made it back. You know, he made it out of Pakistan. And showed up in Mayapur, and when Prabhupada, when he came into the room, Prabhupada got up, went over to where he was and embraced him. And he held him for like 2 or 3 minutes. You know, he was just so happy to see him like that. And so, you know, it's a great surrendered soul to the spiritual master. And so much so that just shortly after that, you know, Brahmananda thought he was in this book, he's revealing his mind. He was thinking, okay, now I'm off the hook. I surrendered. Now, the heat should be off me because, you know, I've done everything Prabhupada wanted me to do. I went to Pakistan. And then just at that same festival, during that same period, Brahmananda got called to Prabhupada's room. And Prabhupada told him, yeah, actually, this is good that you did that, and it's good training for you. It's preparing you for this next thing, next assignment I have for you. And Brahmananda thought, oh no, what's this? Prabhupada said, I want you to go to Africa. So Brahmananda was the first devotee to go to Africa. He got sent to Kenya. And this was like 1971 or something like that. So, you know, he really surrendered. He was a great surrendered soul to Prabhupada. And somebody might say, but yeah, you know, wait a second, but didn't Brahmananda have problems and everything, you know? So my response to that would be, you know, who doesn't have problems? Who hasn't had problems, you see? And also, I think the correct way to look at this, the lives of devotees like this is in this kind of a context, just... Well, it's to see their lives in terms of the love that they had for Prabhupada and the love that Prabhupada had for them. And just to give an example of, you know, what I'm kind of getting at here, is just imagine you're like, you're in the street someplace, you're in a park, and you see a father chastising his adult son, young adult, you know, 20-year-old son. He's chastising him very severely like that. And you think, oh, this is horrible. You know, I have to, this is not right. And you go over and you say something to the father. You say, hey, you can't talk to him like that. You know, what happens is the son, who's being chastised by the father, he goes, hey, mind your own business, butt out, you know. In other words, it's superficially, it seems like, oh, they really kind of like, these people are inimical. You know, there's animosity between them. It's on the surface. It's on the surface. Underneath is like a very, you know, strong bond of love. And that's the way that we have to understand the lives of, you know, Prabhupada and these confidential associates, because, you know, there's a very strong bond of love. Brahmananda, Madhuvisa, Shyamasunda, you know, the list goes on. And they all had problems, and, you know, in the course of their careers in devotional service, some are with us, some are no longer with us, but they're very special. You know, they're very special individuals, and their lives should be understood in terms of, as I said, the love that they had for Prabhupada and the love that Prabhupada had for them. It shouldn't be looked at like a credit rating. You know, when you go to get your credit rating these days, 800 is a perfect score, but if you didn't make this payment on time, then your credit rating goes down this much, and if you forgot to make your car payment, then your credit rating goes. It's not like that. You know, that's the incorrect way to think. The correct way to think is as I was suggesting. So anyway, so hopefully, this, as I said, I was told this program is being organized, and more will be said, and so much more can be said about you know, somebody who was definitely a soul surrendered to Srila Prabhupada. And I know myself that when I had a little association with him, I'm not going to go into the details, but you know, when I was watching the videos yesterday morning at breakfast time, I could see that, you know, just from hearing him speak, you could feel like this is like some special kind of person, you know, very rich personality, very warm personality, and a lot of love for Prabhupada. And anyway, I'm sure that it'll be a nice program, so everybody can attend that. Okay, so Brahmananda Prabhu Ki Jai. So today's verse, which is, I was told by Archer, he was almost ready to steal it off me, because he said this is the, you know, the jewel verse of this whole canto of the Bhagavatam, this particular verse. And yeah, it seems like it is. So in the translation itself, you know, of this verse, the word devotee appears three times, just in the translation. But it's interesting to note that twice, right before the word devotee, is the word pure. And as Krishna says, the pure devotee is always in the core of my heart, and I am always in the heart of my pure devotee. It says, my devotees do not know anything else but me, and I do not know anyone else but them. So, in other words, it's not just any old devotee that's being spoken about here. It's a pure devotee. In other words, the point I'm trying to get at is, we can get inspiration from hearing about this, and we should, you know, like the lives of Ambarish Maharaj and Prahlad Maharaj. We shouldn't expect necessarily this kind of reciprocation from, you know, Krishna for ourselves, at least initially, at least if we know that we're not, if we're in the neophyte stage, if we're not on the standard. In other words, Lord Narayan's making it clear here what kind of devotee gets this kind of reciprocation. The pure devotee, you know, like, and there's a whole series of, this is, I think, the this is the fourth or the fifth verse in a series of statements Lord Narayan's making in response to Devasa Muni's request to, you know, protect him. And so Lord Narayan makes, you know, he's describing the kind of devotee that is going to get this kind of reciprocation. In verse 65, he says, Dharagada Putrapta, which he mentions that particular qualification, was that the pure devotees has no attachment to home, wife, children, friendship, society, and love. And that's a qualification that this, the devotee has. Another one in the next verse, it says Samadarshana, which means a pure devotee's chief concern there is to raise the ignorant mass of people to the sense of Krishna consciousness. And in the next verse, he says he's not interested in the four principles of liberation. So, it's this kind of devotee that gets that kind of reciprocation. And so, as I said, it's something we can be inspired, by. We shouldn't expect. We shouldn't expect to be protected from anything and everything, like Prahlad Maharaj was, or we shouldn't expect to be protected like Ambarish Maharaj was, unless we're on that level, So that's something to bear in mind. Okay, then right in the beginning of the purport, Prabhupada says, Tirasamuni wanted to chastise Maharaj Ambarish. It is to be understood that he wanted to give pain to the heart of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I think it could be, what's meant by that is I don't think what Prabhupada's saying is that Maharaj Ambarish was thinking, okay, here's this devotee of Krishna, let me do something to try to punish him, and in this way I'll give pain to Krishna. Narayan, yeah. I don't think he was consciously thinking like that, but basically what Prabhupada's saying is, for all practical purposes, if you're giving pain to the devotee, it's the same as if you're giving pain to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not necessarily that he was consciously thinking, oh, let me give some pain to Lord Narayan now by giving pain to his devotee. But Prabhupada's making the point that he could have just as well been thinking like that, because by doing like this, trying to punish or discipline a devotee, especially unfairly and unnecessarily, that's tantamount to what you're doing. It's exactly what you're doing. And so in light of that, what Durvasa Muni is requesting is completely ridiculous, if you stop and think about it. What he's approaching Lord Narayan, and he's going, please protect me, please protect me, because the Sudarsan chakra is following me, and I'm just in a very dangerous situation. It's ridiculous, if you stop and think about it. I thought of an analogy, which helps illustrate this point, help us understand this. Imagine that you're in a park, and you're walking with your young son, or daughter, and the family German Shepherd. Okay, and you just, you're in a park, it's got nice hills and everything like that, and you're just going for a nice walk one Saturday or Sunday morning or something. And, so you're walking and you go up, you're down the bottom of the hill, you're in a valley, and your child runs ahead and runs up over the hill into the next part of the park, and you can't see. They're just ahead of you like that, but you can't see them. And then, and the dog is just kind of, they're just always running all over the place, okay? And what's happening, although you can't see it, is on the other side of that hill, some robber, sees your child and sees, look at this very well-dressed kid, probably rich. And the robber goes over to where your kid is, and he pulls out a knife, and he's ready to stab your kid, right? And he's going to do it. He's thinking, I'll kill this kid and I'll take, I'll rob him like that. And meantime, the dog, the German Shepherd, they're running all over the place, sees what's going on. And, these dogs are smart. And the dog can understand that, my master is in danger here. And the dog comes charging, like anything, to where that's going on. And the robber sees the dog and he just forget about, robbing this kid, killing this kid and trying to rob him. I got to just save myself. So the dog, the robber starts running, as quickly as he can. Meantime, you reach the top of the hill there and you can see everything that's going on. And you can see all of a sudden this guy running and the dog chasing him. You don't really, know everything that happened, but you can kind of, you kind of figure it out as the whole pastime unwinds like that. Meantime, the guy approaches you, and he's begging to you, please protect me, right? So what's he going to be, it's going to be a tough one. How are you going to feel? I don't think I'd be as merciful as Lord Narayan. You follow what I'm saying? If I got to the top of the hill and I could see, well, you know, just provisorily, you could see that the guy was about to kill your kid, and the dog came to save the day, and now the dog's chasing this guy, and he's approaching you, asking you to please, you know, protect him from the dog. Why should you? This guy is just about to cruelly and mercilessly kill your kid, right? Your poor innocent child, for no reason other than just to, you know, put some money in his pocket or something like that. And he's expecting you to be merciful to him when you're about to do that to his dearly beloved child. You see, so it's an analogy. You know, it's an analogous situation. This is what's going on here. Here's this Durvasa Muni. He's just about to try to cruelly and mercilessly kill Maharaj Ambarish for absolutely no good reason, right? And he's expecting mercy. You know, and Maharaj Ambarish is very, very dear, as Prabhupada points out here in the purport. It says the feelings are like those of a father who feels pain when the child is in pain. It's like a father-son relationship. You know, he's very, very dear to Lord Narayan, and he's expecting mercy. He's lucky he didn't get punished. What, the speaker get mercy? He's lucky he didn't get, I can't even use the words, you know. He's lucky, first he went to Lord Brahma. He's lucky that he didn't get punished by Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, or Lord Vishnu. This has got to be a pastime. Because, you know, if you really stop and think about it, any of those personalities, if they were aware of what he was trying to do, would have told him, you know, are you kidding? Protect you? You're lucky I don't just, you know, do something to you right now. I mean, this was horrible what he was trying to do. Anyway, so it's, so it was kind of crazy that he was thinking like that, you know, that he was expecting even that. Now, which brings up the question is, how is it possible that Durvasa Muni could be, you know, this covered over? You know, and he was very covered over because, you know, let's analyze. What is he? He's a mystic yogi, okay, but he's a brahmana. It's mentioned he's a brahmana, and he happens to be a mystic yogi on top of that. So what is the duty of a brahmana? The duty of a brahmana is to not, find fault, curse, condemn, and punish people. It's to instruct people and elevate them. I mean, you know, if he was like in his right mind, he would have done something like this. Oh, Maharaj Ambarish. Oh, you know, you've broken the fast before, you've eaten before I've come. That's a discrepancy, isn't it? You know, something like that might have been an order. And even then he would have been corrected because there was nothing wrong with what Maharaj Ambarish did. As mentioned previously, it's stated in some Vedic literature that drinking water is breaking a fast and not breaking a fast. So at best he could have said something like that. He could have said, isn't this a discrepancy in the, you know, Vaishnava etiquette? Or something like that. And Maharaj Ambarish could have explained to him, well, no, you know, your grace or whatever, you know, it's actually okay, blah, blah, blah. But no, what did he do? He flipped out. You know, he totally kind of like, totally overreacted and in a very offensive way. So he forgot that. He forgot totally what his position is and what his real duty was as a Brahmin. He also forgot that you don't, you know, punish somebody severely for some minor offense. I mean, even if he did feel that Maharaj Ambarish had made a mistake, there's that expression, let the punishment fit the crime. Certainly in this case, the punishment is not fitting the crime. You know, you don't punish somebody, you don't try to kill somebody because they maybe, you know, slightly offended you, but broke some Vaishnava etiquette in some very small, minor way. So he forgot about that. And he also forgot his knowledge of the scriptures, which he should have known that Maharaj Ambarish knew. As Prabhupada mentions here in the purport, a devotee knows what's what. You know, he was not at fault. He was trying to chastise him on flimsy grounds. So how Maharaj Ambarish understood that point. How is it that Durvasa Muni is supposed to be a brahmana, you know, a learned brahmana, an elevated brahmana, wasn't aware of this. So he should have been aware of that. So how is it that he was so covered up? Well, as I said, it's a pastime. But also, the way that we're supposed to be understanding this is this, that there's a verse in the third canto of the Bhagavad Gita. It says, Avritam gyanam etena gyanino nichavarina kamanupena kunteya duspadena nalenacha. Thus a man's pure consciousness is covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and burns like fire. See, so that's how Durvasa Muni wound up in this situation. His pure consciousness was covered by lust. You know, lust not just this, of course, this lust for, you know, the form of a man or the form of a woman, or but there's also this lust for power. You know, this lust is there. Material desire is there on the gross and subtle level. So Durvasa Muni apparently was experiencing lust for false prestige. You know, he wanted to be very prestigious. He wanted, you know, he was the important person. You know, it's described elsewhere earlier that he was envious, that he was Maharaj Ambarisha, an ordinary Kshatriya, and his fame and glory was eclipsing his own. And he was very disturbed by that envy. He was envious. So that was what covered his pure consciousness. And that's why he was able to act in this way. Of course, you know, once again, he was put into that position because he was too elevated a soul to actually, under ordinary circumstances, fall prey to, you know, this kind of thing to that extent. But it's there for our instruction. You know, it's there for our instruction that this is what can happen if we allow ourselves to be influenced by, you know, envy or, you know, lust for position. What is it? Lub, puja, pratishta. You know, these things can cover our consciousness to the point where we would become fall prey to engaging in abominable activities. And this is the example. Durvasa Muni, who's supposed to be an elevated Brahmin with mystic powers and everything. And look how he's behaving, you know. Why? Because of that. Because he fell prey. He was victimized by this, Nichavirina, you know, the eternal enemy in the form of lust for lub, puja, pratishta, and to the point where he became so bewildered that he's engaging in these abominable, about to, or he did, you know, engage in these abominable activities. So, yeah. Right, so anyway, what do we learn from this past time? Well, one thing, there's many lessons, important lessons, but one major lesson from this past time is we shouldn't think that we can offend devotees, you know, engage in Vaishnava aparad, and then get protected from the reaction by higher authority. In this case, he couldn't get protected by Lord Brahma, he couldn't get protected by Lord Shiva, and he couldn't even get protected by Lord Narayan. You know, so, and we should understand that that's the case. That's one thing we've meant to learn from this, that you can't, you know, be a Vaishnava aparadi and then think you're going to get protected from the reaction by taking shelter of, you know, the deities, or that's a lesson there for us. And so don't do it. Be very careful. As Prabhupada's saying here in the purport, Lord Chaitanya has very strongly recommended that one not commit any offense. Not just a big offense, but any offense at the lotus feet of a devotee. Such offenses are compared to the mad elephant, because when a mad elephant enters a garden, it causes devastation. So in other words, it could just wipe out all the hard work you've done. That's what devastation is. You know, you spend weeks, months cultivating some nice garden, you know, hours and hours and hours of careful, you know, going in there and just making this little adjustment, that little adjustment, watering, weeding, you know. It's a lot of work. If you've ever done any gardening, you know. And then within like minutes, if a mad elephant gets into that garden, within minutes the whole thing is totally destroyed, ruined, completely. Wiped out. So that's, you know, and that's the analogy that's being given here. That's why it's called the mad elephant offense. Just within a matter of a few seconds, you can wipe out all the effort you've made, all the progress you've made, you know, to advance in devotional service if you perform this mad elephant defense. So in the event that if you think you've already done that, and you know you're suffering the reactions of having offended a Vaishnav, then once again the lesson here is that, you know, that you can't even get forgiven by Krishna for that. You have to go to that Vaishnav and you have to beg forgiveness. Like Durvasa Muni did. He had to, you know, as the expression goes here in America, eat humble pie. Durvasa Muni had to eat humble pie. He had to go back to where Maharaj Ambarish was and beg forgiveness, which he did, and of course he got. And so that's, you know, that's there. And this is not a isolated incident. You know, there's other examples of this, you know, in other parts of the scriptures in the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. There's that famous pastime of that devotee, Gopal Chopal, I believe his name was. He wanted to make Srivast Thakur look bad. So he, you know, Srivast Thakur was having kirtans with Lord Chaitanya and his associates in his home. And this Gopal Chopal, for some reason, he was envious. He went and he placed all the articles of worshipping goddess Durga at the doorstep of Srivast Thakur. So the people, when they come and they'd see, you know, oh, look, he's worshipping the goddess Durga, which was kind of considered like low class in that community, you know. It wouldn't make him look good. It would make him look bad. So he was trying to make him look bad, in other words. And so Srivast Thakur, of course, when he came out and he saw that there, you know, he just thought it was a big joke. He announced out to everybody, look, everybody, look, see, look here, I'm worshipping goddess Durga. Here's all the paraphernalia, you know, the dirty the unclean paraphernalia. But anyways, the offense was there, you know, and he was suffered for that. I think he got leprosy, was it? He came very shortly after having done that. He was affected by leprosy, and he was suffering like anything. He became like an outcast, and had to live on the outskirts of the town and everything. And he saw Lord Chaitanya, and you know, he was a Brahmin, believe it. And he was kind of, you know, he wasn't stupid. He was sharp. He was described as very talkative. But he actually approached Lord Chaitanya and begged for forgiveness. Please, you know, I'm suffering like anything. Please forgive me. And Lord Chaitanya said, forgive you? I don't forgive you. He actually said something that he felt that he should be punished more. I can't remember exactly what Lord Chaitanya said, but he indicated that, no, but what you're experiencing is not sufficient punishment. You should even be punished worse than what you're experiencing right now. But he did. But then he described to him the loophole, which was that if he went back to Srivast Thakur and Srivast Thakur forgave him, then that would be okay. And of course, that's what happened. You see. And then the really a classic example of how serious a thing this is that apparently Mother Sachi once did something. She offended Advaitacharya in some way, and I can't remember exactly what she did or how. I can't remember. Does anybody remember that? How she offended? She offended Advaitacharya in some way, and because of that, when Lord Chaitanya was a pastime where he was, you know, fulfilling the desires of all different devotees. Huh? Oh, right. Yeah, so she was accusing Advaitacharya of like being responsible for Lord Chaitanya taking sannyas, and she was upset by that. Of course, which wasn't the case. Anyway, so Lord Chaitanya, when he was requested to give his mother love of Godhead, he said no, because she's offended at Advaitacharya. And she had to go and beg forgiveness from Advaitacharya and before, you know, and mitigate that offense before Lord Chaitanya was prepared to give her a benediction like that. So it's a super serious thing, to say the least. And something really, you know, don't want to mess around with. And if it, once again, as I said, if you feel like you've already messed around with it, and it's already, well, too late, I've already maybe, who knows, God knows how many offenses I've committed to how many devotees, just pray to your spiritual master, pray to the deities to give you the intelligence how to rectify, you know, whatever you've done, and be prepared to take the humble position and beg for forgiveness, and, you know, see if you can get things straight again. So I'll stop there because I'm out of time. Watch it, Babuya.
Hi, Bhopal. Thank you for a very nice class. In the purport, if I remember correctly, Prabhupada says that Lord Chaitanya specifically says one should not offend a pure devotee. But tellingly, when you read it the first time, you left out the word pure. When you read it the second time, you again left out the word pure, even though you emphasize in your class that this applies to pure devotees. So then it begs the question, does that mean it's open season on devotees who are not pure? That if you offend a devotee who is not yet fully pure, that you're going to get away with it? And if that is the case, how does one recognize a pure devotee? Do they walk around with a light over their head saying pure, blinking all the time? Or, you know, just like we know in the case of Srila Prabhupada, we all accept that he was a pure devotee, but his godbrothers didn't necessarily think like that.
Yeah, well...
Even in the latter days, what to speak of, in the early days of their association with him, they weren't necessarily thinking that they were dealing with a pure devotee of the Lord. So how does one know? You're walking around a community like this, you're dealing with devotees all the time. How do you know who's pure and who's not pure? Is there some external sign that somebody's a pure devotee? Isn't it safer to treat everybody like a pure devotee and not make an offense?
Well, you're answering your own question there in your last sentence. But actually in the purport, Lord Chaitanya doesn't say, in the translation, devotee, the word devotee is mentioned three times and before two of them is pure. But in the purport, it reads like this. Therefore, offenses at the lotus feet of a devotee are serious. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu strongly recommended that one not commit any offense at the lotus feet of a devotee. So it's not mentioning pure devotee here. But But my point is this, that there's actually, Mayapur Shashi used to have this thing outside his office there. It was like an excerpt from a purport from a Bhagavatam verse. I couldn't find it. I tried to find it. But the gist of it was this, that it was saying how Krishna is even very pleased with the neophyte devotees. It's not like he's just pleased with the pure devotees. You know, as soon as somebody's trying to become a devotee, that's very pleasing to Krishna, and that person, you know, is entering into a special relationship with him. So it's not like, oh, I just have to be careful not to offend pure devotees, and then, you know, because that's the only thing that will cause me problem. No, don't cause problem to any devotees. You'll upset. Just like, once again, using this analogy, Prabhupada's using it here, the family, the father and the son. Imagine, you know, there's a family, and the father and the mother, they have like, you know, 12 children, and one is brilliant, you know, one is like such a pet son, he's always well behaved, but they have love for all the other ones too. You know, if you offend any of the other ones, even the ones who are really misbehaved or just very young and inexperienced, they're gonna also be very upset, at you doing something towards them. So the best rule of thumb is don't offend any devotees. We don't know how dear they are to Krishna. So better, there's an expression, best to err on the side of caution. You know, just assume that this devotee is very dear to Lord Krishna, and I got to be very careful. With the speak of devotees, is even an offense, I can't remember where, some pastime, Jiva Himsa. You're not even supposed to offend Jivas, if you could possibly, avoid it. And that's referring to people who aren't devotees, at least at that, consciously devotees. Of course, everybody's ultimately devotees, but Jiva Himsa. So what to speak of people who are trying to practice Krishna consciousness, we're not even supposed to be intentionally offensive towards people who are just in Maya, so to speak, Archit again.
There's a discrepancy between the book and the Veda base. The Veda base says, therefore, one should be extremely careful not to commit offense at the lotus feet of a pure devotee. You're saying that the book you're reading doesn't have the word pure before devotee, but on the Veda base it does.
Oh, yeah. No, it's I'm reading it. Doesn't
so there, say pure devotee. Somebody made an edit there.
Okay. Anybody else? Any questions or comments? Sajid North Prabhu.
In the case of Durvasa Muni, he obviously, after the offense, not even Lord Narayan could forgive him because it was too obvious. What about the offense? What about the devotees, or let's say, in my case, I see things, I commit offenses on my mind, and to a devotee, and then I don't have a chance to actually go and tell them, oh, I commit offense in my mind, please forgive me. What I'm trying to say is that Krishna doesn't forgive the offense, you have to go to the devotee, but when you commit offenses mentally...
I can't remember the Shastric reference exactly, but from what I'm remembering is that in Kali Yuga, you're not held responsible for mental offenses. So you have to actually do it. I'm not suggesting you do, but I'm just saying, it's kind of, you're not held responsible for mental offenses, thank God. Don't go around apologizing to people for offenses you made in your mind. Just start controlling your mind and keep your mouth shut, But if you actually do have made the offense, then you got to try to, then you can approach that person and ask for forgiveness like that. Anybody else? Anything? Okay, thank you very much. Oh, sorry. Can we do one more? Okay. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.